It's Tuesday, November 5, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. It is Election Day in America for millions of Americans, and millions of our fellow citizens will have the right to go to the polls and cast ballots in elections that matter. In at least several cities, new mayors are going to be elected, and at least two states, Virginia and New Jersey, are electing governors. Other kinds of issues are also on the ballots coast to coast. In New York, the big issue will be, in terms of the state, a referendum to change the state's constitution to allow for an expansion of casino gambling. Elections always matter, but in this case, given the fact that we're in the first year of the second term of President Barack Obama, many people are looking at these elections to see what kind of signal they send. Will this be a bellwether year? Will there be a clear pattern in these elections? People are looking with a great deal of intensity at the Virginia gubernatorial race, where you have a very clear conservative Republican running against a veteran of the Clinton administration. In this case, you have Ken Cuccinelli, who comes from the party's right wing in terms of the Republican Party, running against Terry McAuliffe, who's a former Democratic Party chairman, closely associated with former President Bill Clinton. People are going to be looking at that race to figure out what is the political future of Virginia, a state that has been red but has been trending blue, especially in its northern suburbs. The state of New Jersey will also be electing a governor, and there the incumbent Republican Chris Christie is expected to win by a large margin. Christie is hoping for a very big margin of victory in order to set himself up for a run for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, trying once again to be a Republican governor in a blue state with national ambitions. In New York City, liberal Democrat Bill de Blasio is expected to win. He may be the most liberal mayoral candidate in many years, and as a matter of fact, has been well known for his support for the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, for taking a honeymoon in Cuba, and for other things that have put him very much on the cultural left. But Bill de Blasio is going to be facing a number of challenges if he is, as expected, elected the mayor of New York City. And New York State has a big issue on its own agenda. It will be deciding on the expansion of casino gambling. Very interestingly, the New York Times has come out on its editorial page and in analyses and news reports very clearly concerned with the expansion of casino gambling and with the fact that this will put the state of New York in the position of preying on even more of its most vulnerable citizens. It's going to be a very interesting thing to see what takes place in New York because, straightforwardly, the argument is exactly what you think it is. It's all about money. State treasurers are looking for ways to get more money, and in this case, they're looking for the issue of gambling, expanded casino gambling, to bring new non-tax revenue for the state of New York. But of course, the downside to it is massive, and what you're looking at here is expanding the role of the state in preying on its own most vulnerable citizens. In Sunday's edition of the New York Times, the paper ran an article by Robert H. Frank entitled "Dancing with Temptation in a Casino Vote." As he writes, the ostensible attraction of the amendment is its promise to relieve budget woes without new taxes. In proponents' eyes, state income from gambling is a form of voluntary tax payment. But modern casino revenue comes mostly from slot machines, and the relationship between them and some of their patrons is voluntary in only the most superficial sense. Frank then goes on to cite Princeton University Press book Addiction by Design by Natasha Dow Schull, pointing to the slot machine gambling in Los Angeles, pointing to the technical wizardry underlying modern slots and their effects on players. As he writes, according to slot designers and casino managers surveyed in the book, the mission of these machines is simple, to separate patrons from their money in the most ruthlessly efficient yet psychologically agreeable ways possible. Frank goes into detail describing how casinos take advantage of those playing slot machines, lulling them into a psychological state of satisfaction and excitement. He writes, psychologists describe this state as flow, a feeling of being so absorbed in what you're doing that you become completely unaware of the passage of time. Artists, writers, and others who achieve flow in their work call it one of the most pleasurable psychological states, one that greatly enhances productivity. But in hindsight, at least, flow as experienced by some slots players is a state that leads to ruin. End quote. Meanwhile, even as voters in New York will be deciding this issue in terms of this proposed constitutional amendment, in the state of Kentucky earlier this week, keno games began. As Sheldon Schaefer reports for the Louisville Courier-Journal, the Kentucky Lottery will start offering keno, a game with drawings, every 5 minutes, almost around the clock, and an expanded windfall to the state of about $14.5 million a year. In this case, the Courier-Journal is also very honest about this game. Arch Gleason, Kentucky Lottery president and CEO, contends that Keno tends to attract players who are better educated and have more money to spend than players of traditional lottery games. He said the Keno social gatherings tend to cater to higher demographics. Meanwhile, the paper is registering its own disbelief that that's what's going to happen. The Kentucky Lottery began selling tickets at 5 a.m. Monday morning. The first drawing came at 5:05, and every 5 minutes thereafter through 2 a.m., players are able to bet $1 to $20 each play, 7 days a week, 21 hours a day. The only break in the drawings will be between 2 and 5 a.m. daily. In other words, this is a game that thrives, indeed depends upon, human addiction. The Keno game will be available in bars and in other social gathering places. At the American Legion, Shawnee Post 193 reports the paper. Bar manager Don Hopper said he believes Keno will appeal to members, quote, most of whom will bet on anything. Everybody here gambles, end quote, he said. Hopper said he has some concern about so much business on Friday nights from cashing tickets that he might have to add a second bartender. As if all of this isn't morally troubling enough, the article includes this statement. Lottery officials haven't limited the number of Keno retailers and expect the number to grow to around 650 within 5 years. Once again, the government preys on its own people. Meanwhile, on the issue of gambling, World Magazine has a blockbuster investigative article out having to do with Jerry B. Jenkins, co-author of the best-selling Left Behind novels and, as described in the magazine, one of today's busiest Christian authors. He has sold over 70 million copies of his novels and nonfiction works, but he is in this major story in World Magazine because he has become very well known as a player in the poker industry. As the magazine says, he is a former vice president of publishing at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. He now volunteers as chairman of the Moody Bible Institute's board of trustees. In recent years, Jenkins has also enjoyed playing poker, sometimes with friends in the privacy of his home and sometimes in casino poker tournaments that require buy-ins of hundreds of dollars. The article goes into great investigative detail in terms of Jenkins' background in the poker industry, but then it quotes him to say this. Jenkins, age 64, declined to state his income on the record, but he has said he is a high-income person and has enjoyed a few pretty flush years in the Left Behind series. You can do the math, he said. I've sold 70 million books, so to break even making $8,000 playing poker, it's kind of pocket change for me. He says he gives most of his income away. Later in the article, his son Dallas is identified as a professional poker player. The World Magazine article goes into the fact that evangelicals may be divided on this issue. They write the Bible has no explicit thou shalt not play poker commandment. Poker is not the same thing as playing the slot machines, it writes. It does involve skill, though the cards are dealt randomly. Players bet chips and win them by forming the best five-card hand possible and attempt to mislead opponents into believing their hand is better or worse than it really is. Barrett Duke, Vice President of Public Policy and Research at the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, responded by saying that even though Mr. Jenkins may be able to afford his habit, those he is playing against in terms of competitors in these poker games may well not be. He says this, quote, you are basically trying to win other people's money and risking the money that the Lord has entrusted to you. Plus, you're also engaging in activity that has destroyed millions of lives. What makes this story most interesting is the fact that just a matter of weeks ago, the Moody Bible Institute announced a major policy change in terms of its employees, faculty members, and others. As World Magazine reports, the omission from Jenkins comes after the Board of Trustees he chairs established in August a new Moody employee policy that permits, among other things, gambling and the use of alcohol while off duty. Brian Regnerus, a spokesman for the school, said, quote, no board member's personal preference or activity had any impact on the decision to review the previous employee standards, end quote. So even as we're talking about the issue of gambling, it turns out that it might not be so distant from us as we would like to think. It's not only in the state of New York, it's also right here in the state of Kentucky. It's not only out there in the secular world, it's also, as this report makes very clear, involving many Christians as well. Ross Douthat, writing for the New York Times on Sunday, pointed out that the issue of gambling in New York actually asked the citizens of that state to take a risk in terms not only of their own well-being, but of their neighbors as well. He writes, in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, citing a report from the Institute for American Values, nearly every adult now lives within a short drive of a casino. Then he says, and after this Tuesday, that drive may get considerably shorter because New York voters are expected to ratify a constitutional amendment allowing up to 7 more casinos in the state. In other words, now not even just a short drive, but much closer. Douthat then goes to tie this issue to the growing public acceptance of marijuana. He writes that both of these issues have been made possible by the same trend in American attitudes, the rise of a live-and-let-live social libertarianism, the weakening influence of both religious conservatism and liberal communitarianism, the growing suspicion of moralism in public policy. And both, in different ways, he writes, illustrate the potential problems facing a culture pervaded by what the late sociologist Robert Bellah called expressive individualism and allergic to any restrictions on what individuals choose to do, end quote. A very insightful article. He's exactly right. What we're looking at here is the rejection of a moralism that says that we as a society should take responsibility for the weakest among us by not allowing the kinds of activities that will be injurious not only to them, but to the entire society by extension. Douthat is precisely right that this is evidence of the live-and-let-live social libertarianism that is fast growing in America, fastest growing in urban areas, and amongst the young. But Douthat goes on to argue that as you look at this issue, it's not just moralists on the right, conservatives, who should be concerned about this, but liberals as well. He writes, liberals especially, given their anxieties about inequality, should be attuned to the way that some liberties can grease the skids for exploitation, with a revenue-hungry state partnering with the private sector to profiteer off human weakness. Shifting the issue to Europe and a big scandal there, a very revealing incident has taken place. There's a big trial going on in Great Britain. It has been brewing for some time as tabloid editors are on trial for having hacked into the private communications of many people, including the parents of a deceased girl and also the British royal family. This hacking scandal has now brought several people into the dock on trial in Great Britain. Amongst them are two people, Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson. Andy Coulson was a major executive with Rupert Murdoch's media empire before he began working for the government and the British Prime Minister David Cameron there in Great Britain. Meanwhile, Rebecca Brooks was basically second in charge in terms of the tabloid empire of Rupert Murdoch. Both of them are on trial for criminal charges in terms of the hacking controversy, but that has led to a stunning revelation, and that is that these two people, married to other people, were engaged in a very lengthy sexual affair. As Jane Croft and Robert Cookson report, the secret relationship between two of Rupert Murdoch's top executives is a key part of the prosecution case, which alleges that they were part of a criminal conspiracy, the tabloid. When people are charged with conspiracy, the first thing the jury has to answer is how well did they know each other, how much did they trust each other, said one observer of the case. According to the Financial Times of London, police found a letter dated February 2004 relating to the relationship in a computer in Ms. Brooks' London home. Extracts from the letter that Ms. Brooks had written to Mr. Coulson as he was trying to break off their affair was read out to the jury last week by the prosecutor, who said it had caused her, quote, a great deal of grief, end quote. What makes this most interesting is that here you have what most people might describe as payback. You have executives of the tabloid industry that in Great Britain has thrived upon revealing private aspects of public people in order to bring them abject humiliation. And yet it turns out that we have a basic issue the Christian worldview should inform us of in advance. What we're looking at here is the fact that there are sinners everywhere. Sinners reporting for the tabloids as well as being observed by them. And in this case, sinners involved in the very same things they were revealing amongst others at the very top of the tabloid media empire. So it turns out that not only is there a scandal about hacking, the technological invasion of privacy in Great Britain, but now this has led to a larger controversy and conversation about the role of this kind of information in public. And that's where Sunday's edition of the New York Times comes in. Maureen Dowd, very interestingly, points to this incident in Great Britain and says, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult and dangerous to have an extramarital affair. As she points out, in the day of high technology, GPS systems, smartphones, and all the rest, people have to smarten up and recognize that if you are involved in this kind of relationship, you are not just possibly going to get caught, you are probably going to get caught. She asked the obvious question. How can apparently smart people, the very smart people who, after all, were hiring people to run these tabloids and to do the investigative reporting, how can they involve themselves in similar activity thinking that they would get away with it? Something profoundly revealing about human nature is revealed in this story. But there's also a very serious point to be made in terms of Maureen Dowd's column on Sunday. Yes, it is becoming more and more difficult to get away with this kind of illicit immoral liaison. It's becoming more difficult because as the smartphones get smarter and smarter and the technology becomes more and more efficient, it's not just the National Security Administration who may find out about your illicit affair. It's not just the tabloids. You may be found out in short order with the truth revealed by technology. Finally, a very sad tale from the end of World War II. As Allison Smale reports for the New York Times, for all the efforts Germany has made in coming to terms with its Nazi past, the fate of one of the prime architects of the Holocaust has long eluded the authorities and historians. Until now, apparently. Heinrich Müller, the chief of Hitler's dreaded Gestapo, or secret police, was one of the most senior Nazis to escape capture or certified death at the end of World War II, writes Allison Smale. She goes on to say, Holocaust historians say that Western investigators, at the very least, looked for him intensively for years after 1945, and there were reports placing him everywhere from Czechoslovakia to the Soviet Union or even Brazil. So where is Heinrich Müller? It turns out he is very likely buried in a Jewish cemetery. This has led to a sense of moral outrage throughout Germany, not only in the Jewish community but beyond. While the claim is not definitive, there is no forensic verification, it is credible enough to stir a mixture of sorrow, outrage, and shock, writes Smale, in the city where so much blood and treasure have been spent and beyond. Ephraim Zuroff, the chief Nazi hunter of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, said, quote, I can't think of a worse desecration of a Jewish cemetery than to bury Heinrich Müller there. The report makes clear that Müller was probably killed by Allied forces in the very last days as Berlin was falling. He was then buried, but he was then reburied in this Jewish cemetery in an unmarked grave. As the report makes very clear, Heinrich Müller was amongst the most crucial Nazi commanders who planned the Holocaust. He was a participant in the infamous Wannsee Lake Conference in January of 1942, in which the Holocaust was meticulously planned and later approved. As this investigative report makes very clear, there were hints and signals that this was the case long before. A man who had been a gravedigger, Walter Luders, had approached the local police in 1963 in West Berlin, saying he had buried Müller, and he was then interrogated only once by more senior investigators, but then the issue was dropped. Now it has come back because the reports indicate that research makes very clear the credible claim that Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, is buried in a Jewish cemetery with the Jewish victims of the very same unspeakable atrocity. From a Christian worldview perspective, one of the things this reminds us of is the fact that human beings, even in trying to make things right, often just can't get there, and there are some morally horrible, problematic issues that can never be adequately untangled in this life. These point to the necessity of a judgment and of a righteousness and a justice that can only come in terms of God, the Holy Judge, bringing it on that day, the day of judgment. The last section of this article makes this abundantly and chillingly clear. Deidre Berger, head of the American Jewish Committee in Germany, spoke of how little respect there was for human lives during the Holocaust and afterwards. She then went on and said, quote, it is not possible, even in death, to disentangle the victims from the perpetrators, end quote. That statement is undeniably and horrifyingly true. It simply is not possible in this life to disentangle good from evil the way we believe it must be done. And thus we await that day of judgment, when God can and will do what only He can do. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.